This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. We're talking about the week's news with Colin McEnroe, host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Howdy, Colin.
Good morning, Mr. Dankosky. It's great to have you back so I don't have to host anymore. And I do have to just warn you, I have a slight touch of Stemmermania right now. So, and it is contagious. It's super contagious.
We're going to try to find the vaccine to make sure that you don't spread that around. But it's good to be back, indeed. We're also joined today by Keith Faniff. He's the state budget reporter for the Connecticut Mirror, our own budget Obi-Wan Kenobi. Keith, good to see you once again.
Thanks for having me back.
And Suzanne Bates is here, policy director at the Yankee Institute for Public Policy. Hello there, Suzanne.
Good morning.
If you want to join our conversation, you can always join us online on our website, wnpr.org/thewheelhouse. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. We're going to start our conversation in a place where Connecticut is in the lead of a national discussion over guns. While the shootings at Sandy Hook, of course, prompted Connecticut and other states to pass some tough gun laws, it is another shooting 20 years ago this week that's been the focus. On March 6th of 1998, Matthew Beck stabbed and gunned down four of his bosses at the Connecticut Lottery before turning the weapon on himself. He had reportedly been upset about being passed over for a promotion and a raise. The incident prompted the state's gun seizure law, making Connecticut the first state to enact such a measure. Here's State Representative Doug Dubitsky.
This is the type of statute that even somebody like myself, who strongly supports Second Amendment gun rights, can get behind, because it can actually protect people. It can actually save lives, while at the same time ensuring that there is due process.
And now, Colin, other states are looking at Connecticut's law after Sandy Hook. So much of the conversation was about what types of weapons or what types of weapon attachments we might be able to ban state by state or nationally. Of course, federal gun legislation probably is not forthcoming anytime soon. But now, after the Parkland shootings, we're looking back 20 years at this Connecticut law, which states, even including Florida, are seeing as maybe something they can consider.
Yeah, well, I mean, we can talk about Florida in a second. I think it's a really good law. But it also, when you look back at the lottery shooting, at the case of Matthew Beck, it's a more complicated equation. It's always a more complicated equation, and it's why you can't make one set of laws that will cover Parkland and Sandy Hook and San Bernardino and Newington. And each one of these things is a little bit different. A few things about Matthew Beck. First of all, he had a very aware and loving family. His father in particular knew that he had an adult son with mental illness and was a kind of a hovering father who really, really stayed very involved. And of course, he had been hospitalized. He was being treated for depression. He was also being treated by a very talented clinician, a guy that I had some contact with, a guy named Peter Smith, who wound up being sued for malpractice. And there were people who were very, very aware of his problems, of his paranoia and his resentment towards his workplace. And the clinician eventually cleared him to go back to work. I think back in 1998, they just didn't see it. You know, the gun collection, I think today, in a lot of situations, would leap out at a bunch of concerned people, smart, concerned people like Matthew Beck's father and like the doctor who was treating him. And part of that is we have to keep having this national conversation. It's why, you know, after these terrible mass shootings, there'll be some people, many of them in the NRA, who don't want to have a conversation about prevention right after this. They think it's the wrong time, all this kind of stuff. No, it's the right time. The more that we tell these stories, the more that we understand these stories. Like, the law that we're talking about right now is useless unless people understand how to recognize the situation where it should be triggered. In the case of Beck, the problem was nobody sort of put together his paranoid feelings with that big, ever-growing gun collection and thought, wow, that's the problem. We've got to get the guns away from him. Because, in fact, I'm sure his father could have taken the guns away. I think we need to keep having the conversations and understanding one another better. That's as big a part of it as the laws we pass.
Yeah, understanding people a little bit better, Keith, this gets to the heart of a lot of the conversations that happen after every mass shooting, where there's one corner that heads toward, let's try to figure out how to pass more gun control legislation, and the other corner always seems to be about mental health and how we can identify people who may have problems and who shouldn't have guns. Maybe this is a place where these two things come together a bit.
And I think you just nailed it, John, that the problem with, you know, heck, partisan politics is we try to take a situation where something could be complementary and present it as either or. You'll still hear people say, well, listen, if we were so focused about really stemming gun violence, why are we still siphoning money out of our mental health programs? And one becomes an excuse not to deal with the other. I just also wanted to go back to one other thing Colin said. I thought it's really fascinating. In 1998, that was my I had one session up at the Capitol in 93, but then I got back in 98 and I've been there since. And I remember even after the lottery shooting, it just – you know, it seems like it takes so long for us to – what now seems to be common sense to realize, okay, if these guns had been taken away. I just look at the evolution of security in the Capitol. Even after that shooting, you could still enter the lobby of the state Capitol from probably six different doors. I mean, people used to go through the legislative office building in the Capitol like pedestrian traffic. It was a faster way to cut, you know, through to Bushnell Park. And it would take even three more years till after 9/11 before somebody would say, maybe we don't want to have all these doors open, you know, during all business hours and have some with guards at them. It's amazing some of the common sense things that just it takes a while to register.
It really was a different world. Suzanne, what are some of your thoughts?
So I have a lot of thoughts about all of these things. You know, as a mom, you know, dropping my kids off at school the day after something like the Parkland shooting and seeing a police car sitting outside your child's elementary school, it's, you know, I want my kids to be safe when they go to school. And so what will make them safer? And some of the gun laws that are being proposed, I don't think will. But things like this, I think, will make them safer. So I'm very much interested in what are solutions to the problem. And I think sometimes we rush to the gun argument. And I think we should have that conversation for sure. But I also think there are other conversations that we don't have because we rush to the gun argument, you know. Like school security, like, you know, my oldest child went to school in New York City and there was a guard at every door. There was only one door in the school and there was a school resource officer at the door every morning when I dropped him off. And it wasn't scary for him. You know, that was the norm. And, you know, we need to talk about why, too. Why are kids shooting kids? I mean, it's anyway, sorry, I have many, many thoughts.
Well,
about
no, but I think that they're good thoughts. But what's so interesting, though, Suzanne, is. We're having a conversation after Parkland that does feel a little different than the conversation. We didn't have a conversation at all in America, frankly, after what happened in Las Vegas. I mean, there literally was no conversation except for a couple of back and forths about whether or not we're going to ban bump stocks, which was something that most people in America hadn't really heard about. The conversation that I think we'd like to have was subverted over the course of the last couple of weeks by talking about whether or not we should arm teachers in schools, not about whether or not we could have school resource officers more prominently featured or better security. I mean, literally a national conversation was had about whether or not we should arm teachers. And I don't know that that gets us any closer to the productive conversation that you're wanting to have.
Well, I think, you know, I mean, look, we live in a part of the country where that conversation makes no sense. But I think there are parts of the country where, you know, maybe that's not the wrong conversation to have. I think, every time we shoot something down or stop talking about something, you know, we don't make things better that way, right? So in Connecticut, arming teachers isn't going to work. Okay, well, let's move on. Like, what does work? What will make our children safer? You know, I think that's the focus that we need. And some of the rhetoric, it's been so heated and so divisive. You know, I hear Senator Murphy, you know, I just find some of that rhetoric so divisive. You know, there are people who really strongly believe in Second Amendment rights. And Condoleezza Rice was on The View the other day talking about this. And she was talking about how, you know, during the civil rights era, you know, there was civil society had broken down and they weren't being protected by the police. They felt like they were being hunted by the police. And her father and other black men in her community were armed and were protecting, you know, their community. I agree with Keith that this is not an either or. You know, we need to talk about all of these things, but I think we need to be thoughtful about the conversations that we have.
I think one of the reasons that the rhetoric has gotten so heated is because there's been so little action. And I think if Chris Murphy seems like he's flying off the handle sometimes, it may have to do with actually having walked Sandy Hook parents through the halls of Congress looking for some kind of progress on this and being told, no, we're just not going to do anything. We don't care that, you know, that your kids, your little kindergarten kids were murdered. We don't care. We're not changing the gun laws. And I do have to say, and I hate saying this in this situation because I don't like being hyperpartisan. This is a Republican problem, all right? The Republican Party has refused to do anything about this. This isn't a national problem. It's not a bipartisan problem. The Republican Party, because of their deep involvement with the NRA, has obstructed meaningful gun legislation for decades now. And it's another reason why maybe you're hearing some heated rhetoric, because they won't do anything. And I do think we're at a turning point now when you hear some of the things that maybe Senator Rubio and others are willing to talk about. We may be at a turning point, but I think it's one of the reasons people have gotten really angry, because these things keep happening and the answer is always, nope, not doing anything about it. Sorry.
And the flip side, I think, is when Republicans hear things like they don't care about children, right? That's just so untrue.
Well, it may be untrue.
That's just so untrue.
And I didn't say that. I just said you won't. Republicans won't do anything about it.
No, that Senator Murphy walked families around and that they heard, you know, that Republicans don't care about these kids. Of course.
I didn't say that. I just said they wouldn't do anything. I didn't say they don't care about kids. But if they won't do anything, they've got to live with that.
The path to solution, right? People see different solutions here.
Right.
And I think, you know, when you say that the other side doesn't care about kids, and some of the rhetoric.
Never said that.
No, I'm saying Senator Murphy, some of the rhetoric he has used, you know. It's been so inflammatory that it just shuts the conversation down.
But really, when you're walking families around, you're just looking for a bill on background checks, universal background checks, which is a pretty easy get for most Americans. And you've got congressmen essentially turning their backs on these families. Yeah, that's why people get mad. That's why these kids in Parkland are so mad, too.
So what's interesting here, Keith, is a state legislator, Arthur O'Neill, who's been involved in this issue for quite some time, a Republican, has been pitching this gun seizure law around the country. He's been saying, you know, Connecticut's law that is in place in some form in a couple other states is something that other states should look at. And as Colin suggested, Florida Senator Marco Rubio, who quite famously post-Parkland shootings stood up and did a town hall meeting and just got destroyed by people who were there who said he wasn't doing anything, now seems to be moving in a direction that Art O'Neill and others in Connecticut from his party think he should go.
I don't mean to be cynical, but I think it comes down to, I'm kind of going to echo a little bit of what Colin said. It's such a polarizing issue, and sometimes we get these issues that are so crucial, nothing really changes until people are willing to risk their reelectability. And that's what it comes down to, because there certainly are some states where to come forward with the type of changes that we're talking about would cost people their jobs. And there are a few times in history when it will get to a point where somebody's going to say, yeah, but I can't see any other solution. And I think that's where a lot of the frustration comes from, because regardless of how you feel about the issue, I think everyone would agree here. There are some people who are saying, I want this level of action, whether it gets you kicked out of Congress or not.
Well, and I think, Suzanne, that that's one of the issues in Connecticut is, of course, is you can be a Republican in Connecticut and not risk your reelection by taking a firm stance on guns, because Connecticut is Connecticut. And so we can have gun laws that are quite a bit different than Florida or Georgia or a lot of other places. The problem is, and we see this all the time, is that without any sort of national action on gun reform of whatever sort, meaning background checks, changing the availability of certain weapons for certain people, all of a sudden you have a flow of guns that will not stop at state borders. Connecticut can have all the protections it wants, but if somebody else somewhere else decides we want to arm whoever with whatever weapon, those weapons will come here. And that's why that national conversation that Senator Murphy's trying to have is very much different than the one that's happening up here at the state capitol.
No, absolutely. And I think that people in Congress should have that conversation. And I hope that there are solutions like universal background checks, like this law that Connecticut has, that could be passed nationally. I don't think Senator Murphy is helping the conversation. I don't think he's furthering the conversation with his rhetoric.
Well, let's ask Colin whether or not Luke Bronin, who's running for governor, he's the mayor of Hartford, whether or not he's helping the conversation by asking lawmakers to delete the NRA from state statutes. I guess I didn't know that the NRA was in any state statutes, but this is what he wants to do.
Yeah, I think it comes as a surprise to a lot of people. I'll say this. It's an interesting thing to bring up. And so we should say the NRA is in state statutes in terms of requirements for safety courses. It says you either have to take as part of the permitting process, you either have to take an NRA course or a similar one. And I think people are surprised to hear that the NRA is privileged in statutory language in any particular way, especially given kind of the role that they've played in this debate over the last couple of decades. I don't know that changing that language would materially affect anything. I think probably the same gun safety courses would be the same gun safety courses. On the other hand, I think the same reaction a lot of people did, thinking, wow, yeah, why would they be written into the law? I mean, that's even kind of unusual and maybe an indication, one of many, many, many indications of their incredible lobbying power that they get themselves written into the law as the dispenser of gun wisdom. I don't think Governor Malloy helped things very much by calling them a terrorist organization. There's 5 million of them. A lot of them are perfectly nice law-abiding gun owners. I mean, you can't judge them all by Wayne.
But isn't LaPierre. That what Suzanne's talking about, Colin? I mean, you know, you just said maybe Governor Malloy isn't helping the issue. She's saying maybe Senator Murphy with his rhetoric isn't helping the issue. I mean, is that part of the point she's trying to make?
I think there's two different things. I mean, I think name-calling and calling them a terrorist organization, I just don't think I don't think that flies. I mean, it's fine for Michael Moore to say it. I don't think governors should say something like that because it does – it just starts describing 5 million Americans who include some perfectly nice people. I think for Murphy to get mad when there's no action and when so much of the process does seem to be controlled by the NRA, the way there's statutory language at the federal and state level that just seems like, why does Florida have a law that penalizes towns that try to enact any gun law stronger than the existing state law, that you can be punished by the state? Like, who wrote that law? You know, how did that law get written? How could such a law like that even exist, that a town can't have a tougher gun law than whatever the state law is? I mean, that to me feels like something, the work of NRA lobbyists. And I can understand getting mad about that, and I can understand Murphy getting mad. Yeah, he brings these families to Washington, and people kind of turn their backs and say, nothing we can do. I understand that kind of anger. I think the name-calling probably isn't going to help very much.
Yeah, I mean, the laws are passed by people who've been elected. I mean, there are a lot of people who feel very passionately about the Second Amendment. And I think that Senator Murphy, if he really wants a solution, needs to act more like someone who wants a solution instead of someone who seems to want to throw bombs and accuse people of having blood on their hands. That kind of rhetoric doesn't bring people to the table and to a solution.
If we want to talk about things that Connecticut could or could not do to put money where its mouth is, we read Keith and CT News Junkie this week that Connecticut does have something like $16.5 million of investments in 6 pension funds invested in 5 companies that manufacture guns. Is this something that anybody talks about at the Capitol, whether or not the state should, given its strong anti-gun stance, seemingly, should divest itself of investment in some of the gun makers, including some that exist right here?
Honestly, it does not get much attention at the Capitol. My cynicism's coming out. Like, I think like a lot of fiscal issues, it does not get a lot of attention. I do think you're going to begin to see some discussion on it. But no, I wish I could give you a better answer than no. Most people are not really paying close attention to that.
One thing we could say about this is physician, heal thyself. I mean, anybody who has a 401k or a SEP or an IRA that has stock funds in it, unless you have specifically worked with some kind of broker who is guaranteeing clean hands, there's a pretty good chance that if you have invested IRA or any kind of retirement savings, you probably own some gun stocks too.
Colin McEnroe is host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Keith Vanniff is state budget reporter for the Connecticut Mirror. Suzanne Bates is policy director at the Yankee Institute for Public Policy. When we come back, we're going to be talking about the Commission on Fiscal Sustainability and Economic Growth. I know that doesn't sound exciting, but trust me, the conversation we're going to have about it is going to be gripping here in the Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. You can always join our conversation on our website, wnpr.org/The Wheelhouse. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. Joining us is Keith Faniff. He's state budget reporter for the Connecticut Mirror. Suzanne Bates is policy director at the Yankee Institute for Public Policy. And joining us, as always, is Colin McEnroe, host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. He ably sat in my chair for the last couple of weeks while I was away. And you've got your own show to do today, Colin. What's on your show?
Well, assuming that we don't get snowed out somehow, which I don't think is going to happen. We're going to be talking to Yasha Monk. He's a political theorist we've worked with in the past. What he writes about, and particularly in his new book, is the notion that we see democracy as something that it's a kind of progress which, once it's achieved, it stays in place, which actually was the case for quite a long time. But you look at countries like Poland now, or maybe even look at the most recent Italian elections, and it does appear, though, that you can revert from – you can lose democracy. Democracy is more fragile than people really understand, and there might be even some reasons here in the United States to bear that in mind as we move ahead.
I really hope that conversation doesn't get snowed out, because I want to listen to it, maybe by the fire with a cup of hot chocolate. Colin McEnroe's show this afternoon at 1 o'clock on WNPR.
By putting our heads together as commission members, we've coalesced around a set of proposals which, taken together, and only if taken together, put Connecticut on track to sustainably balanced budgets and faster economic growth as called for in the law. In sum, the Commission's recommendations can change the course of Connecticut's future.
So that's Jim Smith. He's co-chair of the Commission on Fiscal Sustainability and Economic Growth, talking about the Commission's recommendations to right the ship of state. There's a whole bunch of stuff in their plan. I'll turn to Keith Faniff first to just maybe give us a couple highlights. I mean, what are some of the things that this commission says that the state should do, first of all?
John, if you look at it at first, it's kind of like an octopus. There are a lot of flashy waving arms that get your attention. And if you kind of burrow down to the core of it, that's not to say the other parts aren't worth mentioning, but probably the key to it is a redistribution of the tax burden off the income tax onto the sales tax primarily, corporation tax, and indirectly onto the property tax, because it talks about cutting about $1 billion out of state spending in a budget that everyone agrees is largely strapped with fixed costs, and there's not much, really much of any place left to go. We're already seeing this trend, except to cut municipal aid. There are proposals to legalize tolling, raise gas taxes. There is a proposal to try to promote some proposals to promote regionalization, probably not as much as I think some people were looking for. You've got, again, some big flashy things like let's try to create some new urban campus with a specialization on science and technology in one of our big cities. But there's not really any breakdown on how we're going to pay for something like that. I think more than anything, what I was struck by this was that it seemed like just about every single group along the political spectrum had a part of this that they claimed was a non-starter. Mm. That, I think, is the biggest concern.
And before I turn to Suzanne and Colin for some feedback on some of these ideas, what we heard Jim Smith say is these recommendations, if taken together,
right,
and only if taken together.
Right.
So you're talking about this octopus that has all these arms, and a lot of people don't like some of the arms, but maybe they like some of the other arms. But he and his colleagues on this panel are saying that this is a plan that's got to hold together. A $15 minimum wage increase has to hold together with the shifting of taxes and the building of this new college campus. That seems like the hard part.
Right. I get what they're saying, though, without condemning or condoning, because they're basically saying we structured it so that these elements are all synergistic and they work together. Now, whether people actually agree that would be the result is another thing. But I understand what they're saying. We're saying, they're definitely placing some real burdens on labor. I should have mentioned, they're saying when the current CBAC contract expires in 2027, basically let's end collective bargaining, to decide fringe benefits. That should be resolved by the General Assembly. So there won't be any more negotiating for vacation benefits, retirement benefits, healthcare benefits. I think when they're making some of these proposals, that's when they're saying, okay, we need some offsetting things. I still think, though, that's why I try to really look at what's it doing more than anything else. And they're because the second half of that long-winded name we were kind of joking about is economic growth. And I'm not dismissing the idea of tolls. I'm not dismissing the idea of the urban campus. But the biggest way they're trying to move the numbers is to ease tax burdens, particularly on the wealthy, because if you take $2 billion off the income tax burden, about three-quarters of that are going to come from households probably making more than $500,000 a year. You're going to shift it primarily onto the sales tax with a higher sales tax rate, and also by getting rid of a lot of sales tax exemptions, a portion onto corporations and a lot onto the property tax base. That's very similar to the strategy that Tom Foley espoused in his campaigns, which is economic growth sort of through trickle down and undefined spending cuts that we'll find somewhere. Well, we can see where we can cut, and all that's really left in big numbers is town aid and, to a smaller extent, higher education. That philosophy hasn't really sparked a lot of economic growth. I mean, when we – you know, John, when we created the state income tax, we cut taxes on capital gains and dividends for the wealthy tremendously, and that didn't produce some huge growth in Connecticut's economy. That's the part where I think this is struggling to gain some traction, this report.
Colin?
First of all, I think we should say, I don't know if we've said it yet, this commission is, I believe, a creature of legislation. I think it wound up in the budget bill or an implementer or someplace like that. So it's a creature of legislation, and it's a bunch of people who are, for the most part, real luminaries in the business world and in related areas. I just want to say, first of all, that it's a very public-spirited endeavor, and they've given their time and their brain power generously. I think that's all needs to be. Two of them, I should say, are friends of mine, Greg Butler and Roxanne Cody. I think all that needs to be acknowledged before we start picking it apart.
And we should acknowledge that the Robert and Margaret Petrocelli Family Foundation is a funder on Connecticut Public Radio. Bob Petrocelli is one of the co-chairs, along with Jim Smith, who we heard from.
Right. So that said. Or having said all that. Okay, I'll quickly try to run through four problems I have with it. The first problem is they have correctly identified one of the – and this is something Keith has talked about a lot – what they group in as exemptions. So these are people who don't have to pay or have to pay less or institutions or whatever. There are exemptions to our tax system that have been granted over the years on a piecemeal basis. They say it's, I think, $5.2 billion per year. If you eliminated all of them with a magic wand, you'd have $5.2 billion in new revenue. They don't have a magic wand. They talk about eliminating, I think, 14% of the existing exemptions, but they don't say which 14%. They correctly identified that part of the problem is that some of these are lobbied for by very effective lobbying firms who go in there and get these exemptions in the name of economic development or whatever else. You know, unless you're planning to send the, you know, lobbying core of the state capital to Guantanamo, I don't think you're going to successfully disturb a lot of this stuff. And if you don't specify where the 14% is, chances are the people with really good lobbyists are going to make sure it's not their 14%. To me, that's a recommendation without meaning. If you can't get more specific about it and say how you're going to do it and how you're going to fend off attempts to by everybody to preserve their little cookies, it's words that don't really have a lot of meaning. I would sort of say the same thing about this $1 billion in efficiencies. So Keith mentioned those. And remember – Everything has to work according to them. All of these things have to work. They have to be passable by the General Assembly. They have to work. So one of the keys is $1 billion in efficiency. In non-fixed costs somehow. How do they know there's $1 billion in efficiency? Well, they asked a consultant. What kind of consultant? Well, the kind of consultant that they would recommend hiring to do this cutting. In other words, all they really say in that recommendation is we should hire a consultant who can come in and cut $1 billion. And how do we know that that can happen? Well, we asked one of those consultants. Well, once again, that doesn't prove to me that there's an easy
– I could go in there and cut $1 billion
right.
for
you. Could you just maybe show us $500 that you could cut just on your own?
But you can find that money, because I tell you guys, I'm thinking of a number between 1 and 4, and it's not 1, 2, or 4.
Yeah.
We can figure out what number I'm thinking about. And the same thing with the – exemptions, okay? Two out of every $3 in tax breaks we provide right now are on the sales tax. A lot of the other ones that we don't would be very, very impossible to move, arguably for good reason. On the corporation tax, a lot of them what we call business inputs. If you start taxing things businesses use to make products, you're just going to drive up the price of the product. So we can see where it's going to go. You've got to look a little deeper, but it's there, both where with the $1 billion in undefined cuts and with the tax exemptions. So, I mean, I heard a lot of conservatives who are frustrated because they were saying to me, okay, where is the recommendation for a new tier two for teachers? Where was the proposal for if we're going to reduce state spending, which is ultimately going to reduce aid to cities and towns, what are we doing to help towns curb those costs? I'm not saying there was – I think there was a lot of value in the report, but I think it just shows how deep the problem is. And I think people felt that they needed to be shown a little bit more. How are we going to make these things work? I think they wanted it fleshed out.
Let me just mention two more things really quickly.
Yeah,
one of them is – Keith has also alluded to this. Look, there's one chart in the report that shows sort of what kinds of taxes we rely on the most and in what proportion. And if you look at that chart and it compares us to other states, it's pretty clear that we rely on the property tax to a really – a much larger degree than almost any other state except New Jersey. So – and they really don't really do anything to address the property tax in there. And their biggest idea for some kind of revenue source other than property taxes, if I understand it correctly, municipal sales taxes. So think about Hartford, which has kind of a crushing property tax burden. They do have an interesting proposal for what they call SILOT, which would be different from PILOT, but it would be service charges for nonprofit, non-tax-generating properties in cities like Hartford. But basically, their other idea is that it would cost more money to buy stuff in Hartford. Like, Hartford doesn't already have enough problems. They should have their own municipal sales tax so that doing business in Hartford becomes even more expensive. So I think property tax is a huge problem, and they kind of didn't really touch it. And as Keith is suggesting, some of our property tax burden might grow as a result of some of these efficiencies they find at the state level. And very quickly, also at the urban level, they're in love with CRDA, which is the Capital Region Development Authority. It's been many things over its many decades of existence, but it's a regional quasi-public, which they think should be used as a model for at least two other cities. I would use the CRDA to teach bad public policy. I think the CDRA is a massive failure. If you think Hartford's a basket case, which I think this report kind of argues at times, blame things like the CRDA, which are very, very poor models for economic development. I was shocked. I mean, I kind of threw up in my mouth a little bit when I got to that part. I thought, really? The CRDA? Where Front Street took 20 years to develop and it still doesn't do what it originally set out to do? That's your great model.
Acid reflux is one of the things that comes along with the stemmer mania.
Yeah,
so please just consult your doctor. Suzanne, what do you see?
So I think it's great that they're trying to come up with a grand bargain, because clearly, you know, I mean, look, one of the things it says in the report is as they started to dig through, you know, how bad are things in Connecticut, they knew things were bad, but all of them came away feeling much worse about how things were in Connecticut than they went in. And, you know, we need some kind of big picture, big grand bargain to get things moving again in Connecticut. And yeah, of course, there are people who want to peel back, you know, every little thing. And you know, I don't like everything in this report. I mean, there's, you know, I think the $15 minimum wage would not lead to economic growth. So I think that, you know, there are things that that I have concerns about. But, you know, we need to do something. And I have to push back a little bit on this idea that the labor reform in there is a lot. I mean, the labor reform is small. But really, if you want to get at what's causing some of our property tax growth, binding arbitration is huge. And they do suggest some small changes to binding arbitration. I mean, our neighbor to the north, Massachusetts, just took, you know, healthcare out of binding arbitration for municipalities. And here we have one of the most expansive binding arbitration laws in the country and in our region. You know, in a union friendly region, we are an outlier on this issue. And it is, I mean, talk about what's causing our property taxes to explode. I mean, this is the culprit. And, you know, we have to get it at that law. And so they make some small changes. I think the other thing that I really saw is how much the legislature locked up when they agreed to the benefits package, you know, that we sometimes call CBAC, but it's, you know, it was the sort of state employees benefits package last summer. When they locked that thing up, they made it very difficult for anybody who wants to do reforms. I mean, the 2019 budget session is going to be awful. It's going to be awful because there are so few places that lawmakers can go to make changes. And I think you saw some of that frustration even in this this commission and this report.
I didn't have a particular problem with the labor stuff that was in here. I, as you know, you and I agree more about that than people might guess.
So Keith, what are the chances for some of these reforms or all of these reforms to actually be acted on by the General Assembly, given the fact that there are so many people that hate so many things that are in there,
right.
The fact that labor, as we've said, has a huge problem with it, and just frankly, we haven't really talked about this, that some people have raised some questions about the makeup of the panel itself, the fact that labor representatives aren't on it, the fact that it seems to be, to some extent, a bunch of rich people, and that there hasn't been maybe as much transparency about the process as there could be. I mean, I don't know. It feels as though this is all a lot of work that's going to either be not acted on or torn apart limb by limb by the legislature.
As far as this year, I'd say the chances are somewhere between very slim and bupkis. And that's not even a failing of the commission. That's the complete polarization of the legislature, narrow margins, election year, everything we've heard before. People just aren't, quite frankly, ready. And even if you say, well, isn't there something like, okay, couldn't we pick this item? The danger with that is someone else will say, I've got another item that I think we could pick that's safe. I predict this year, it just – the legislature is not ready.
But let me just push back and say,
sure.
But I wonder if the commission – I mean, there's been a conversation for several years now about electronic tolling and the gas tax, something that I think both Democratic legislators who might want to consider this – want some cover on, right? Does the commission provide some cover for a larger conversation about increased gas tax or tolling on the highways that we wouldn't have had before because people don't want to touch tolls? But the commission seems to think that this is a key part of whatever Connecticut needs to do moving forward.
I think they provide some cover. Is it going to be sufficient to move the needle on tolls? Probably unlikely. Maybe. You have a shot at a small, we'll call it a patch-style gas tax increase. Somebody figures out, you know, if I put 2 or 3 pennies on the gas tax, would that be enough to stave off during the summer and the fall while I'm running for re-election? A reduction in weekend rail service in the Danbury or Waterbury line, or will that keep this train station open? Maybe. And even that, it's just so difficult right now. I just wanted to quickly add on this group. In their defense, because, you know, I say there is no good root canal, okay? These guys are dealing with a problem. There was no plan they were going to give that people were gonna like.
And the Root Canal Commission would have been a nice
exactly.
idea for a title. But anyway, yeah. Please continue.
There's no good fall out of a third floor window. It's like, exactly. I want a much better fall. If they had come out and said, hey, let's raise taxes tremendously and pay down debt and let's make all these investments – and inevitably, people would have, you know, pointed out accurately that's going to weaken our economy. We're going to get diminishing returns. But by the same token, when they come out and they say, listen, let's shift income tax burdens onto consumers and businesses, and they concede, well, yes, the primary benefit is the wealthy, but that's just a byproduct. That's not what we were aiming for. And by the way, you can argue that whatever economic growth, if any, you get out of that is still not going to match the rising debt costs. It's still going to worsen wealth inequality. You're still going to have more people without health care, more people without access to higher education. None of these, no matter what, I tried to take both ends of the spectrum. Nothing's going to look attractive when you're dealing with a mess like this. And as much as we talk about it here, a lot of legislators still aren't ready to accept that it's going to get worse before it gets better.
I have to turn to Suzanne quickly because when I said the word tolls, you actually made a face that I could feel, not so much as see. And so I just wanted to quickly turn to you to either comment on that or on what Keith just had to say.
So I mean, on the tax plan, I actually like the tax plan because I think it restructures to make it more stable. I mean, if our system is going to be destabilized every time a rich person moves out, then we're in trouble. So we need we need to create a more stable tax structure.
I'm sure there's anecdotal evidence to back that up.
Well, and then on the tolls, I mean, look, the tolling system that's being proposed, right? I mean, we're talking about 13 of those tolling stations in Massachusetts versus 72 that are being proposed here. I mean, it's going to be a huge – talk about a transfer onto the working class. I mean, you know, who are the people that travel the farthest to go to work? It's the working class in Connecticut. You know, everyone's, oh, we need to catch the cars that are coming from out of state. You know, fine, that's a nice idea. This will mostly be paid by people who live here. And so it's a huge extra tax, essentially, on – You know, and we haven't really talked about why our state transportation fund is so broke. It's because we put the money in the wrong places, you know. And so it's the whole tolling conversation is very frustrating, I think, for those of us who see it as an extra tax. But
yeah, I know we have to move on here. I just want to say one thing, though. I mean, I think they, in insisting that all this stuff is tied together, that it can't be cherry picked, you can't pull out some things and keep other things. And we can let's pass over Mr. Patricelli's somewhat awkward metaphor for all of this. They've kind of doomed this thing to a life on a dusty shelf somewhere. I think it's a noble effort in a lot of ways, but if that's really their position. Just to put it into something that will conform to your recent past, John, you were recently, last week, you were in the rainforest. It's like, have you seen the way the legislature acts? You know, have you seen the way that they fumble and stumble over much more pedestrian kinds of reforms and changes? It's a little bit like, John, that you took a large, complicated box of a future piece of IKEA furniture out there and put it down for the monkeys and said, I want that assembled by the end of the day and do it right, and then stormed away. What's the likelihood the monkeys are going to have the chest of drawers ready for you by the end of the day? Well, I mean, doing that with the legislature, saying, look at this complicated thing. You got to do it exactly the way we told you. Don't screw it up. You know, I mean, that's just not very realistic.
To be fair, Costa Rica has some very well-organized and thoughtful monkeys. But anyway, Keith,
I got nothing on the monkeys in the chest of drawers. But, and I agree with Colin in part about the shelf. I just don't think it's a dusty shelf, because one of the real services this commission did, and it's important, it's subtle, but it's important, they burst some more balloons. There are still too many people on all across the political spectrum who think there's got to be some way to get out of this with no pain or inconvenience. And more people are finally looking at it.
I agree with that. I think some of the language in this report is really good and constructive.
People are – they sobered up a few more people.
Mm. Oh, okay. Sober at the Capitol. This sounds good. Keith Vann of State Budget Reporter.
Sober monkeys are important.
Suzanne Bates, Policy Director of the Yankee Institute for Public Policy, and our own Colin McNamara. We're going to come back in just a minute here on the Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. We're talking about the week's news with Colin McEnroe, host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR, Suzanne Bates, policy director at the Yankee Institute for Public Policy, and Keith Vaneth, who's the state budget reporter, the Obi-Wan Kenobi of the state budget at the Connecticut Mirror. The nomination of Andrew McDonald to be Chief Justice of the Connecticut Supreme Court has become a nasty partisan political fight. Here's Governor Malloy defending his friend, his political ally, and his nominee.
The justice proved himself worthy of this position over 13 hours of testimony where he explained law to non-lawyers, where he explained precedent to those who might not otherwise understand it. I thought he answered every question. And quite frankly, I think people came to the hearing having already decided they weren't going to support him.
Okay, so Colin McEnroe, I know that you've talked about this a little bit already on the Wheelhouse in my absence. I mean, what is happening here with Andrew McDonald and legislators at the state capitol?
Well, I will give you my interpretation of it, and some of this. Also, I had a rather interesting interview with Len Fasano, the Republican leader of the Senate, on Monday as well. In a better world, Governor Malloy might have understood that he has kind of a popularity problem, that Andrew McDonald is very closely linked to him, that he has already managed to do something very nice for Andrew McDonald by making him a justice of the Supreme Court with no prior judicial experience, and maybe leave it at that and maybe pick somebody else, and maybe Richard Robinson would be the nominee, and we wouldn't be having these conversations. But that's not what he did. And we have to live with the situation that we have. Now, I basically think what has happened here is mostly about numbers. I think the Republicans have the numbers to create trouble right now, and so they're doing it. They have lots of reasons for doing it. I think very few of them have to do with jurisprudence. A lot of them have to do with score settling and, as I say, irritation at Malloy and maybe a feeling that he's trying to do a power play where in the last days of his time, he can, you know, he can appoint somebody who will be Chief Justice for 8 years. The problem is that when you make something like this political, and that's what's happened right now, everybody's worst instincts are going to come out, and they're already coming out. And I think it's ultimately unfortunate. I also think that the power of the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Connecticut is somewhat overstated and somewhat overrated. Some of the people who've held the post have been very powerful, but basically you're taking a justice and adding some administrative duties to that justice and some leadership roles. I just think what's going on is unfortunate right now, and I think it's going to get worse before it gets better.
So I think that's interesting because I don't know that it's necessarily just a partisan issue, right? I mean, you have a Democratic state senator who's come out and said she's going to recuse herself from the vote because of some bad blood between her and Andrew McDonald. So yes, the Republicans have sort of been, opposed to him as well. But I mean, there are Democrats who are also raising concerns on it.
Well, just to be clear, Senator Schlossberg has recused herself because of longstanding things that go back that involve two different cases argued by her husband, one of which was argued on the other side by Andrew McDonald's husband. This isn't about her feeling that or her stated feeling that Andrew McDonald can't be a good Chief Justice. What she's saying so far is, I can't be impartial about this. I shouldn't vote on it.
But when you read the exchange that they had that was, captured in this legal document, I mean, it sounds like there's some bad blood there. I mean, he screamed at her in a way that, sounds quite disturbing. And I think there are people who have legitimate, I don't think this is just partisan. There are people who have legitimate concerns about, some of the decisions that he's made. And so.
Like what?
I go back to the Catholic Church bill.
That's not a decision. That's a bill.
Well, I'm sorry. So the bill that he made, that to me, right? I mean, religious liberty is one of those first principles, right? If he's not capable of seeing why that bill was a problem.
Well, that bill didn't pass. He passed. He ultimately, apologized
right,
for it.
But
I believe
the fact that he proposed it.
Well,
it was so clearly unconstitutional.
Correct me if I'm wrong.
Face.
Was he not asked by some Catholic lay people to propose something because of an embezzlement problem that they'd had?
Lawmakers are asked to put forward legislation all the time, and it's easy to turn around and say to your constituent, hey, that's not constitutional.
But
the number
of state legislators who have proposed or sponsored bad bills is roughly equivalent to the number of state legislators. And the Republican position on this is the official stated Republican position by every person who's opposing him right now is this has nothing to do with anything he did as a legislator. This is John Kissel, Len Fasano, they've all said they think he was an exemplary legislator. They've said that again and again. So I think it's unfair to sort of say, well, it's really about this bill that he proposed a long time ago.
But I think it gets back to Colin's original point, which is it very much, Keith, is a political appointment given his long tenure in the legislature. And whenever you have a former legislator who has a series of bills that he's voted for or voted against, that comes up into the conversation.
Exactly. I follow Suzanne's point. I just don't think it's sufficient, though, to say, well, listen, I can point to, for example, a fellow Democrat who had issues with him, and I can point to some substantive areas where Republicans disagree. They absolutely do. And I realize Chief Justice is not the same as an Associate Justice, but he was overwhelmingly confirmed as an Associate Justice with a lot of Republican support.
Yeah, 30-3 in the Senate, knowing about that horrible
and
Catholic.
I go back to what Colin said. Look, the numbers have changed. What you said, John, Governor Molloy's popularity has changed, not for the better for him. And the fact is, when the administration came in 2011, they came in with a lot of energy, and they were certainly criticized as being arrogant, as kind of running roughshod over the Republicans. And I'm trying to remember how Colin referred to it. I might be recalling this wrong. There were some bitter feelings, or there's some lingering resentment. And that adds up. That absolutely adds up. And I think all those things come into play. That's not to say that there aren't people who didn't agree. But, I mean, there were all the same philosophical differences. The matter of the legislative proposal when he was a senator regarding monitoring of the finances of Roman Catholic parishes, that certainly was not an obstacle, as Colin pointed out, when he was confirmed as an associate justice. So what's really changed since then to me more than anything are the political numbers and, quite frankly, the growing frustration over the years with the administration.
So, Keith, what happens at the state capitol with this? I mean, not the numbers in the Senate?
Boy, this is one where you hate to just make a prediction, but how does the governor really rescue this one. He can't even get himself into the budget. Notice how I brought that back to the budget, into the negotiating room. Okay? He's still really on the outs in so many ways with his own party. We've got a session that's only going 2 months. It's going to be hard.
In 10 seconds, I'll quickly say, I think Fasano and Claritas are the ones who are going to figure out how this comes out. And they may have to think about what the ultimate effect on them is going to be. In other words, how are they going to be understood by the public if they go against McDonald on this?
Colin McEnroe hosts The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. He'll be talking about can democracies die later on today. Keith Vaniff is state budget reporter for the Connecticut Mirror and a Jedi Master. Suzanne Bates is policy director at the Yankee Institute for Public Policy. Thanks so much to Scott Brady, who produces The Wheelhouse. The executive producer is Katie Talarski. Our technical producer is Kion Wolf. We'll be back next week.